Welcome, folks. This is the Ontology Rules of Logic Programming for Reasoning Applications mini-series. It's Thursday, November 21st, 2013. This is session two in the Concepts and Foundations of Rules and Ontologies, Logic Programs, Classical Logic, and Semantic Web. It's actually the third session in the Ontology and Rules series. Our slide should be up. And I'll just briefly introduce the series and this session. There's some URLs in the briefing itself that takes you to the Ontolog pages that are appropriate. Pascal Hitzler is my co-chair on this, and he'll be introducing most of the speakers. If you look at slide two, this is just a summary recapitulation of the topics that we're covering in this mini-series. It's a continuing mini-series. There's a number of sessions this year, and we may continue after the Ontology Summit next year. There seems to be a strong interest in that, but that's TBD. So you can see that we're basically covering ontology and rules, both knowledge representation and tools, requirements, use cases, design, optimization, and applications. Slide three, the goals. I won't spell these out, but it's basically to kind of sketch out established practices and also new technologies for ontology and rule reasoning, including semantic web technologies and extensions to those. And, of course, logic programming, which has been a strong component of reasoning all along. And then architectures and visualization explanation technologies. Slide four, this is the third in our mini-series, the second with the same topic. And the next one will be December 19th, reasoning applications, and then rule standards in January, and more to come. Slide five, today's agenda, we'll basically have four speakers, approximately 20 minutes each, and a follow-on discussion of about 30 minutes, question and answer from the participants and among the presenters. With no further ado, Pascal, would you like to introduce Marcus?
Thank you, Leo, for starting the session for the overview. So our first speaker will be Marcus Kretsch. Marcus did his PhD at the Cultural Institute of Technology in 2010 in the Semantic Web Group of Rudi Studer. And I was very fortunate to be able to work with him while he was there and I was there as well. Marcus then moved to the University of Oxford for the subsequent 3 years, so he was there until very recently, and has now started a junior research group at TU Dresden in Germany, which is funded by an Emmy Noether stipend. And if you know those, these are I would call them the King's Roads to becoming professors in Germany, so a very prestigious grant. And I'm very happy that he is here now to talk about his work on the relation between rules and ontologies, and looking forward to the talk. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Pascal. Thanks for the very nice introduction. So what I want to talk about today are existential rules in ontological modeling, but before I really look into what existential rules are, I would like to talk about rules in ontological modeling from a much more general perspective. I think a lot of things are happening in that space recently, but I think there's also a lot of other uses of rules that are not in ontological modeling, and I would like to clarify what I mean here first. Slide two, please. So when I look at rules and ontologies these days, then I think it is fair to say that we have a very different perspective on the two in most cases. So an ontology often is something like we see on the top right here. So this is a fly's brain, actually. So this is a fruit fly color-coded brain structures, neuroanatomy model, as it is done by a research group in Cambridge. And they are actually using morphologies to model this brain. And you can see that this is quite typical in many ways for how ontologies are used today. So they are structural models. They are very static in a way. They describe something which is very complex, has many hierarchical components, and is difficult to handle in an intelligent way. But it is not something that changes. You know what you want to represent there at design time. So they have a very clear idea what the structure of this brain is, with some open issues, of course, which are subject to their research, but they want to model this structure and make a computer use it. On the other hand, if we look at rules, rules as such are inherently computational. They are models of computing solutions to problems. When you have a tool like an answer set programming tool, it's called an answer set solver because it solves a problem. And you usually use the rules to specify a problem and then run a solver to find a solution to that problem, for example, to optimize something. And problem solving then happens at runtime. Of course, from a mathematical perspective, as a theoretical computer science, I would say these are just two views on the same thing, right? If we want to show that ontological reasoning is hard, we often use ontologies to model computations. But in practice, it still is a very different approach, and it leads to very different tools as well and very different traditions. Slide 3, please. So if you look at rules these days, they are strongly about computation. You have logic programming, where already the name tells you that it's about computing something. You also have rules in data access. Datalog is a famous example of a query language. Again, you specify an information need declaratively, but then it is computed. The answers are computed based on a database, so you don't know yet what you will get there. Information integration and data exchange are another scenario where we see a lot of rules being used in databases. We have dependencies, which are rule-like structures that are used to model certain constraints, for example. And this is maybe closest to what I would say is ontological modeling, because sometimes what you want is really to model in an abstraction of the database in that way, something where all the constraints are satisfied and which is, again, a structure. And of course, then there's this fourth point, which is a bit of a vague thing, where we use rules for derivation. So even in description logic or ontology reasoning, often when we describe how we do the reasoning, how the algorithms work, we use rules to describe that. So to speak, meta rules that derive something or that produce new consequences. I don't want to talk about these today, but they are also an important computational paradigm where we use rules. Page 4, please. Now, even if when I want to use rules for modeling something, then an obvious question that arises is the question of open world versus closed world. And I think there's another very related question that I would like to discuss here. So the concept of open world is something we often find in ontological modeling, where the idea is that allowing for an open world is a kind of unknown unknown, where we say, we may have certain things, certain truths that we are not aware of yet, and we want our system to behave sanely, even though there are things which we don't know about yet, and which we don't even know that we don't know about them yet, and which might become known at a later point. This is closely related to monotonicity of reasoning. It's also related to entailment, in a more technical view of the whole problem, to entailment versus model checking. Entailment means that you try to infer consequences that are true in all possible models of the ontology, including models where certain additional things are true which we may not have considered when modeling, whereas model checking is computing results based on one particular situation, one model, as you would find it in database or maybe in verification, where you build one particular model that describes your problem space and you want to inspect it in a certain way. Now, besides this typical open world question, there's also another type of unknown information or underspecified information that we find a lot in ontologies. And these are so-called anonymous elements. So we may know that there is something, but we don't know exactly what it is. So that would be a kind of known unknown. In databases, we often refer to these as nulls. In RDF, we know them as blank nodes. In most logics, including OWL and description logic, they are existential quantifiers, as opposed to constants, which have a name and denote one particular thing. In general, we do not want to make a unique name assumption on nulls because we can never be sure that they are not the same as a certain constant elsewhere. So if we say that there is something anonymous there, we may not be sure if it may be the same thing that we already consider elsewhere in our structure. And this is quite important to have this type of feature in many ontological modeling applications. Now, let's look at how the situation is in rules. Page 5, please. In rules, we find that, well, the traditional view, of course, is a closed-world view, and many people would immediately say rules are closed-world, but that's not necessarily true. Of course, prologue is a closed-world setting, a traditional closed-world setting where we have negation as failure. Data log as a query language is in another sense as well, because we inspect one particular database, and we want to find information only about this one thing. But on the other hand, we can also have open-world and even anonymous individuals in rules. For example, in this database paradigm of tuple-generating dependencies, we do have existential quantifiers, and we do have inferred elements that we don't know the exact identity of. And so this is much more open world in many ways than prologue is, for example. Next slide, please. So what I'm saying here is that in principle, rules can be open world or closed world, and therefore we might also use them in model ontologies. Why would we want to do that in the first place? The main thing that comes to mind is that rules are much more expressive in certain senses than ontology languages we use today often are. And the foremost thing that comes to mind there is probably that rules can express arbitrary relational structures. So if you model in OWL and use OWL class expressions, for example, then your the relationships you can describe in that way are usually tree-shaped or roughly tree-like with some small exceptions. So it's very hard to model cyclic structures. It's very hard to model certain interrelations or parallel relations that you find in some application areas. I have given some images here to illustrate that. One is a complex molecule from chemistry. This is obviously not a tree. And it's really hard to model this in OWL with a terminological axiom. You can only model it as an RDF graph or an A-box in OWL, maybe, assertions. But you can't model it terminologically. And on the other side, there is a little process diagram that shows how things react in a chemical reaction. Again, this kind of reaction is not a tree, but different components of the reaction interact in certain non-tree-like ways. Now, rules can express these structures quite well, and due to this, they are also naturally compatible with conjunctive queries. So we can ask, for example, Sparker queries or things that are similar to Sparker queries in expressivity over a rule language much more easily than we can do that over OWL. It's still unclear whether it's even decidable to answer a basic graph pattern based on OWL semantics. And lastly, maybe we also have options to extend this in non-monotonic semantics, which is still better understood than in ontology languages, I would say. Next slide, please. Okay, so after setting the stage a bit and motivating this, I want to briefly introduce on a very high level here what existential rules are. So it's actually quite simple, really. So an existential rule is a formula of this form. It's like an implication where I have a certain body structure, B1 to Bn. It's a conjunction of things. They all have to be true. And if they all are true, then I infer a hat, which is, again, a conjunction H1 to HK. And the special thing, and this is why these are called existential rules, is that the hat may have existential quantification. So I'm allowed to infer that there is something which I don't know exactly about what it possibly is. So there might be some unknown individual here. And these types of rules, very simple in structure really, are known under a number of names in the literature. In databases, they are really these tuple-generating dependencies that I mentioned earlier. They also have been studied under the names data log plus minus, and for all exists rules, especially when used for knowledge representation. But I prefer the term existential rules mainly because you can Google it, as opposed to the other two, where it's really hard to find the right hits if you just type in this name. Okay, so next page, please. What's the semantics of this? Well, we can just use these implications as first-order logic formulae under a standard open-world semantics and Tailman semantics. We can sometimes make a unique name assumption. Databases like to do that because it's natural in the application. The main practical entailment problem we want to solve there is conjunctive query answering. I mentioned that before, so that's the natural thing you want to do on a rule structure. You may still be able to infer something about subclasses, for example, by interpreting the results of such conductive queries. Unfortunately, and this is the main thing with rules and maybe the main reason why they are not used much more widely, is that fact entailment is undecidable in general. So it means you may find that your algorithm runs into infinite loops. It has been argued many times that this is not a problem if you want to solve problems, because problem solving is hard and you never know how long you want to wait. But if you want to describe a structure like the brain of a fruit fly, you definitely want your algorithm to terminate at some point. You want this to be a well-defined, clear structure. You don't want to solve a problem where you don't know in advance if the algorithm is going to finish. So this is, however, a well-defined semantics, but it has this complication. So what do we do about it? Next slide, please. Page 9. So actually, a lot of research has been done in that space, and much of it has been done very recently. So I would say in the last 3 to 5 years, a lot of new results have been found, and it has been very exciting, really. There are basically 3 approaches. I don't want to go into details of these here. We can discuss that later if we like. One is to somehow limit the structure of the rules to make sure that they only generate finite structures. So even if we derive that there are new things around somehow, it will stop after a while and we will have a finite structure to look at. It's going to terminate. We can generalize that further and say, okay, well, maybe infinite structures are also fine as long as they are regular and essentially they are very boring after a certain time. We just have to compute them up to a certain depth, and then we know everything else is going to look like things we already saw, and we don't have to continue. So this is called guardedness in general. There are many ways of guarding rules to achieve that. And finally, there is an approach called boundedness, where we can somehow limit the recursion among the rules to allow query rewriting and basically transform our set of rules into a set of queries we can just run. And each of these has a number of publications associated and an interesting and deep theory related to that. So let's look at one more thing before I conclude. Page 10, please. Non-monotonicity. So tactically, it's very easy to introduce non-monotonicity into the formula. And I want to argue here that it is also useful to do that from an ontological point of view, from a modeling point of view. So we can just use this by adding default negation to the body of a rule, and then we have several ways of interpreting this, for example, under the stable model semantics, like an answer set programming, or under the well-founded semantics. I want just to show an example without going into any technical details here. Page 11, please. Which is from a recent paper, which is mentioned here on top if you want to know any details. So this was about modeling chemical structures, like the one I showed you before. You can see that it's quite easy to do that with rules. For example, here I want to model the structure of methanol and say, if X is a methanol molecule, then there are atoms Y1 to Y6, which are related to X with this half-atom relationship, and Y1 is a carbon, and Y2 is an oxygen, and Y3 to 6 are hydrogen molecules, and they have certain bonds between them. So you can see here I can really just write down the rule or the structure of the molecule as it is in the application, which is quite convenient. In this case, I generate the structure. I say if I have methanol, then I will have these atoms. I can also do the other way, the other direction, and say I recognize the structure based on what I see in the model, and say, for example, to define that to find that something is an organic hydroxy molecule, I have a certain rule again specifying a structure and saying if this structure is there, it is an organic hydroxy. But conversely, I can also say what an organic hydroxy is by saying if I have one such thing X, then I should infer that there is such a structure of atoms. The problem is if I do that, these are the two lower rules I just talked about, then I will obtain certain cyclic dependencies, which may not be very nice, because it might be I recognize an organic hydroxy structure in my model, and then next thing is I apply another rule to generate another version of it, or at least partly generate a new version, and this might not terminate, or it might lead to very strange models. And we use non-monotonic negation here to prevent this type of cyclic dependencies. We basically say, and this is the red part in the model, whenever I recognize an organic hydroxy X, I tag it as being a recognized one, and I will never apply any rule which derives more structure for this recognized molecule because I check whether it's recognized. So this is little RH here. And conversely, if I have generated any new atoms to satisfy the organic hydroxy structure, we will never recognize it again as an organic hydroxy. This is why I use a D here. Okay, so this should be enough to just sketch the idea of using non-monotonic negation here in a way to ensure that a certain finite structure is faithfully modeled in an ontology language. Next slide, please. So what can we do with that? We are on page 12. Non-monotonic existential rules can be used in this way to solve concrete problems. What we did in experiments was to use it to do chemical classification. So there are big chemical ontologies where people try to say something like every organic hydroxy molecule is also an organic molecule, things like that. And most of these properties are based on structures, and so it should be possible to do that automatically if we can represent the structures in logic. Unfortunately, this rarely happens today because no logic really can handle it. So we used a bit of data, a number of molecules, functional groups, and classes, and ended up with some 80,000 rules in total, and we threw this whole bunch of rules at an answer set solver, concretely at DLV. Unfortunately, it timed out after 5 minutes, so we did some more work to find ways to process it. Actually, we did a static analysis on the program, partitioned the rules, and used DLV in multiple stages, and in the end, this just took us 13.5 seconds to classify the whole structure with 8,600 something new subsumptions of chemical classes. So you can see here that we can actually do something which is very similar to classification in ontologies based on a rule language which is not even monotonic. And we can do it quite fast, but it doesn't work out of the box because answer set solvers are not usually optimized for this type of load. So let me conclude, page 13. I want to argue here that rules can be used for ontological modeling, and this is something which is really different from using rules for problem or constraint solving. We can also do that, but it's a different problem. It's not the problem that ontological modelers necessarily encounter. I claimed and showed how existential quantifiers can be used in rules to derive new structures, similar to what we do in our. I argued that closed world and open world are not such a strict boundary in this world, but that we actually can mix and match properties of these and can use semantics as it fits our application. What I think is important to discuss here is that many things are still very inconvenient if somebody wants to use this technology. First of all, there's no unified syntax or even file format other than RIF, I should say. And RIF has also very little tool support, I think, and also very little community support in some cases. So it's very difficult to even exchange the rules we generated here. Related to this, there are very few libraries which I can just use to represent rules in Java, for example, like the OWL API, which does that for OWL very nicely. There's no such thing for rules, I think. There are no tools like Protégé that are used to model ontologies in rules. And also the reasoners we have, also there are very strong reasoners in the rules world, are not optimized at all for the needs we have here. I illustrated this with the little example that we readily obtain, even for quite small sample sets, data that is not processed very nicely with current tools. Okay, that's all I want to say. Thanks a lot. I think we have questions later, right?
Thank you very much, Marcus. Pascal, you want to introduce the next speaker?
I will do that. Our next speaker is Hector Perez-Urbina. He did his PhD at the University of Oxford and completed in 2010, and then subsequently joined Clark and Parsia, the company which you know primarily, I believe, due to the pellet reasoner. So Hector will tell us a little bit about the industrial perspective on modeling with rules and ontology. Please, Hector.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Pascal, for the introduction. Today I'd like to talk about some of our experiences with our customers some of their struggles, some of their suggestions, and their experience with using rules in order to model ontologies. We think, we have learned a great deal about how rules are, known, are used, and some of the misconceptions that are very popular that I see already in the chat. We'll try to talk about more about the, from the practical perspective of things. Next slide, please. So just a quick introduction. Clacom Parsha, as Pascal mentioned, we maintain the reasoner pellet, and lately we also maintain Stardog, which is an RDF database, a triple store, which also allows reasoning, and we basically focus on the tractable profiles of OWL. We also support Swirl, which is why we have all these concerns and all of these issues we have been encountering with respect to rules. So we specialize in semantic web with services and technologies. We have some clients in the federal government here in the United States, and we also have some products such as Pellet and Stardog and some others. Next slide, please. So the first thing that I'd like to say is that rules really rule. I mean, our customers really like them. Most of them, or at least, I would say most of them, really prefer them over axioms. They don't seem to realize that most actions are also rules or could also be expressed as rules, not all of them. For example, if we talk about Swirl in particular, we would find that, for example, existential rules, such as the ones that Marcus was describing, are not part of the language. So some kind of existential quantification on the right hands of actions cannot be expressed as a Swirl rule, and that is one of the main things that we will see later. But most of the easy axioms say, class hierarchy, property hierarchy, domain, range, etc., can be expressed as rules. So this is one of the main thing that we try to, tell our customers, not to be afraid of axioms, because axioms are actually in a vast number also rules. So we try to make them think of them as being animals of the same kind, just as with different disguises. So it is true that there are some differences which are crucial. I talked about existential quantification, as Marcus mentioned, but also rules, on the other hand, allowed, as Marcus also mentioned, allowed to model some kind of structure. And having the variables explicit in the rules is usually very helpful to users in order to understand what's going on. Axioms don't have variables, as we know, so sometimes the variable is explicit, as we know, but sometimes it is harder to actually see what's going on. Next slide, please. And next slide. We're now on slide 4. Right, so one of the first things our customers ask is, why is the syntax so verbose? Okay, we know that in particular Swirl can be serialized as RDF, and RDF has multiple syntaxes. The one I'm showing here is the most verbose. This is the RDF XML syntax. But even if we go to Turtle or some other more concise syntaxes, customers are usually wondering why we don't have a standard, simpler syntax for rules, such as some kind of data log based or some kind of if-then syntax, etc. So we have decided to actually support this for our customers, but this is just a couple of suggestions that we have implemented, and it would be nice if there was a standard in order to standardize this kind of syntaxes, so we all vendors could use and all tools could also produce and use this kind of syntax. So the first syntax we come up with was basically the if-then syntax. This is very similar to Sparkle, as you can see here on slide number 5. the if-then syntax, basically, we're inspired by Sparkle. And then we have these clauses, if or then. And people really like this syntax. Our customers really like it because they're used to, some of them are used to Sparkle already, so they can actually draw some comparisons. And this syntax has been quite popular. Next slide, please. On slide number 6, we see another suggestion, which is more palatable to people coming from a logic perspective, from a logic background, which is the Datalog syntax, which is, you know, very similar to what Protégé shows when we are trying to edit rules using Protégé. So this, of course, is also quite simple to understand, and people find it much better than any of the serializations of RDF. Next slide, please, number 7. So the problem with this approach, I mean, these syntaxes on their own are fine. However, since we don't have a standard and since we're dealing with RDF, what we had to do is we had to encode this into RDF again. So what we've done, I'm just showing some RDF graph, which uses Turtle in order to basically encode the syntax of the rules as if it were a literal, right? So we are using that rule content data type property, and then we specify the rule as the literal, and then we have we have parsers to actually extract that thing and parse it accordingly. However, as you could see, this is suboptimal. It would be better, we believe, if we had a specification for the syntax itself without having to resort to this kind of trick. I see a question here by Enrico and the RIF syntax. Usually, the problem with RIF is that we don't. I'll talk about it later when we talk about editing tools and Protégé. So next slide, please, which is slide number 8. This is the same example with Datalog syntax, but embedded in Turtle. Next slide, please. So now we are on slide number 9, and this is the second most popular question: is Protégé the only option? Protégé is very useful in order to start playing with ontologies. Started coming up with a simple class hierarchy of like a property hierarchy, domain and range, etc. But when it comes to rules, it's actually quite difficult to manage rules in Protégé. It's quite cumbersome, and it doesn't. I mean, as you can see here, just having a couple of rules is actually kind of difficult to use. So this is another thing that we need, that we believe it's needed in the space, some kind of rule authoring management system that treats rules as first class citizens and allows for easy edition, management, creation, etc. As far as we know, I don't know if there is a tool that allows you to come up with RIF syntax or RIF rules, and also we do not currently support. One of the things that is very good about Swirl is that we can actually consider Swirl rules as part of the ontology, and we, at least for startup, we do not support RIF for that kind of application. Next slide, please, number 10. So about understanding rules. One thing is trying to use them and trying to, come up with them, manage them, create them, etc., edit them. But another thing that we have found is that our customers have some kind of misunderstandings about rules, and sometimes they struggle a bit with some of the semantics. Now I'm going to talk about more about the semantics of the rules as opposed to the syntaxes. So in the next slide, slide number 11, one thing that our customers are quite worried about is for the application, for the whole infrastructure applications that are building for that to be quick, fast, to be performant. So that is the main reason why we decided to stay on the tactile profiles of OWL in startup, right? However, it is surprising for them to learn that using Swirl can actually take you out of the profiles quite quickly. It is true, for example, QL does not allow for a qualified existential quantification on the left-hand side of axioms. So this rule, which seems very, very trivial and innocuous, is actually could not be represented using a QL axiom. So people want, our customers want to be able to stay in a tractable fragment such as QL, but they will also like to stay, to be able to use rules because they like them. So this is one of the things they struggle with, they see the limitations on the profiles to start with, a bit arbitrary. They don't understand why, qualified existential quantification on the left-hand side of axioms is problematic. They don't understand why EL, for example, does not allow for inverses or RL for existentials on the right-hand side, etc. So when we come up and say, oh, yeah, but now you have a rule which takes you out of the profile that you want, is a bit problematic. So in this case, I think, we just need to educate our customers better and to let them know why these limitations are there. Next slide, please. On slide number 12, this is another issue that we frequently encounter, which is the creation of new individuals. So unlike what Marcus was describing, which is existential rules in which we derive the existence of an unnamed individual, our customers are usually not very interested in that kind of thing. Existentials on the right-hand side are alien to them in many cases. They don't want to know that by virtue of me being human, I must have had a human father, say. Basically, what they want to do in this respect is to create new named individuals. So, for example, they would like to use Swirl built-in predicates in order to concatenate and to create a new URL and then assert that that newly created URL is an instance of such and such. What they would try is a rule like that shown on the bottom, right at the bottom. Father implies that that person or that thing has a child. As you can see there, child is an unsafe variable because it does not appear in the body of the rule, and that is forbidden for good reason in Swirl. That this is the kind of thing that they would like to do. So what we resorted to do in this case, if we go to slide number 13, is that we allow to use the UUID, our UUID function and the bind built-in of Swirl in order to create the new thing, the new individual, explicitly on the body of the rule. And then we can actually use it in the head. This is no longer an unsafe rule, so it is kosher to be used. But of course, it comes with some problems, right? Because every time we bind here for child, we create a new URI, say. But as you can see on the second rule, that second rule can be broken up into two rules. The first one, which is equivalent to the first one here on top, and a second one with that has child on the head only. The problem we have here is that we are creating two different URIs, and one is related to father via the has child relationship, And the other, which is separate and indifferent, is asserted to be a child. So basically, using this kind of trick is not useful if we want to reuse the new individual in multiple body, in multiple atoms in the head. So perhaps, I don't know, maybe what we usually tell our customers if they want to do this, if they insist to do, on doing this, would be something like, you know, create your new individuals beforehand, do some kind of pre-processing step, and then come up with all the new individuals that you want, and once that is stable, you can go ahead and try to reason in an ontology, and et cetera. Next slide, please. Number 14. So I've talked about syntax, I've talked about semantics a bit, and limitations of modeling with rules. And now there is another misunderstanding or you know, an issue here when it comes to actually reasoning with rules, to actually coming up with answers to their queries. So if we go to the next slide, slide number 15, this is the, one of the, also a very popular question. When does a rule fire, right? Some of our customers are used to triggers, for example, from databases. They're used to some kind of materialization-based approach in which you kind of play, you push a play button, and then, you know, all the inferences are computed and stuff like that. They don't seem to realize, well, they don't realize that there are multiple ways of reasoning with, you know, with rules, and in the context of OWL and SWIRL, you could either do materialization, you could do forward chaining in the context of the tractable fragments, I should say, or you could do a lazier approach, which is based on backward chaining and query rewriting. So Startle, in particular, implements the latter approach. We do query rewriting, we do the reasoning, the query is expanding on, at query time with respect to the T-box, and then the expanded version of the queries is evaluated directly over the A-box without further reasoning. And this is something that usually our customers find a bit confusing because they don't really know when a rule fires, and the answer to that question is it fires when it needs to fire. When it needs to fire, which is at query time, in our case. So we have an example here, a very simple example, has parent child parents, and if the parent is a male, then you can infer the has father relationship. And if we have that were our only rule in the T box, and then we have that A box, Hector Senior has parent Jose, Jose is male, and Hector, my father is Hector Senior, then using materialization, or forward chaining, we could actually infer and make that triple in the bold that we can see in slide number 16. We can see it, we can infer that new triple, okay? If we go to slide number 17, we have that when the query comes, the query that is asking for all the fathers in this case, we know that the result is going to be both Jose and Hector Senior, and this is by virtue of us having materialized the knowledge base first with respect to the having materialized the knowledge base. Yeah. So if we go to question number eight, if we go to slide number 18, we see the alternative. We see the alternate approach, which is query rewriting. In this case, we do not eagerly materialize the knowledge base, which can lead to problems with respect to truth maintenance. What happens, for example, if we have materialized and then a person decides to remove a rule or to remove an axiom or to remove a fact, you would have to maintain consistency with respect to this kind of thing. We try to avoid those kinds of issues by doing reasoning on the fly when queries come. So we have the same query there on top, which is asking for all fathers. And we have the T-box, which in this case is simply one rule. And then what we do is we use a resolution-based calculus and we're writing an algorithm that actually allows us to expand the original queries with respect to the T-box, and we get an expanded version of the query, which usually is a union of conjunctive queries. In the case of QL, it could also be a recursive data log query in case of EL or RL. And after we have done that, we can simply, on slide 19, we can simply evaluate the expanded query with respect to the A box, and then we would get the same results. So this contrast between the different techniques is usually something that our customers find a bit confusing. If we go to slide number 20, just to finish my talk.
Yeah, we're going to have to finish here shortly,
yep.
Enrico.
Yep. This is the next slide. If slide number 21, just a quick note that the SURL specification is not complete. It has, especially with respect to the built-ins, many built-ins we have found that our customers need, we have found that they are not there, and so we have had to actually add them using our own namespace, which is suboptimal, of course, because, I mean, we would like all of these rules to make sense across vendors and across tools. So that's it. That's all that we have, that I have to say for today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Hector. Our next speaker is Hassan Ait Kasi. I'd like to introduce him. He received his PhD at UPenn, and then I actually met him at MCC. He was a member there when I was a student researcher, Austin, Texas. Subsequently, he's gone to Simon Fraser University as professor and iLog and IBM after that. Now he's at the University of Lyon 1. His focus throughout his research career has been on basically multi-paradigm programming environments. I recall life, logic inheritance, function, and functions and equations. The WAM tutorial, of course, people know about that book, and also his interest in efficient implementation, especially, for example, of subsumption reasoning. Hassan?
Well, thank you very much for this very nice introduction. I could not recognize myself. I have a lot of slides, but don't be scared. I'm not going to cover them all. I'm going to rush through most of them. But first, I'd like to qualify a bit my position. As Rio said, I've been in this sort of trade, whether knowledge representation and rules for knowledge representation for a long time. And I have my own biases, of course. Part of what I'm going to try to say is that there are some very interesting paradigms that ought to give a good binding between the representation of knowledge and or data and the use of rules over these representations. So next slide, please. So I kind of have a very short outline. I just tried to, because it was tutorial in the session that I attended was a tutorial on logic programming and logical reasoning in general. So I apologize in advance, but the first part is going to be rather basic, only pointing out some very subtle paradigm shifts that one may overlook if not paid attention to. So constraint logic programming is going to be essentially the paradigm I'm going to go over, with unification as a particular constraint solving that most people using Prolog are used to. And then I try to build on that to say that if we take unification itself, it's a very powerful yet limited reasoning device. And I go from the standpoint that I'd rather work from the data up to the reasoning over this data than the way around. It's like building a house by starting by the foundation rather than the roof. Anyway, so next slide, please. And the one after that. Okay, CLP, or constraint logic programming, can be expressed very simply. If you take a prologue clause, like appending to list, and would like to rephrase it as a constraint logic programming, what you would do is evacuate everything that deals with the argument structure into a particular part that you will call a constraint. And the only way the relational atoms, like append here, may occur is only with variables that are all distinct among one another. And this is very important. Other than that, it's only notation for conjunction. Next, please. Slide number four. The nice thing about constraint logic programming is that it abstracts away the constraint over the data and will just give a semantic that is general for any kind of rules over any kind of data as long as they have what's called a language, a constraint language. And we need very little about this language, not even syntax. We need to know basically what variables occur in it and how to recognize a solution of such a thing. Slide number five, please. Okay, so we can take a relational set of rules and add constraints to them, and the only thing that we ask is these things to be closed under conjunction and implication, basically to get horn clause logic if we're limited to unification. Slide number six, please. So basically a rule is pretty much like a prologue rule, except that it puts on one side anything dealing with constraints. So you have rules that are horn clauses, but dealing only with atoms that contain variables that are all distinct from one another. This is very important, as we can see on slide seven, please. The main computation rule is what's called constraint resolution, which generalizes resolution for first-order logic. It basically takes a resolvent, which is a conjunction made of two parts, relational atoms on the left and constraint formulas on the right, and take a renamed program clause, identifying all the variables of a certain relational atom in the constraint resolvent with the head of this clause, and essentially doing the obvious substitution that will never fail of splicing into what was the occurrence of the relational atom, the body of the rule that are all relational atoms, and on the constraint side, add the constraint related to that rule. So slide number eight, please. So it's important to ask oneself questions. You know, when you present this, a lot of people are saying, well, what are you saying? Constraints are logical formulas, so why not just use logic? And again, it's good. Yes, they are formulae, and they are logical formulae, but they appear in conjunctions, and conjunction is a commutative operation. And because the relational side never has any failure occurring in it, all the reasoning, so to speak, dealing with constraints happen on the constraint side. So the constraints presumably are called constraints because you have a specific algorithm to solve them. And these are very important facts. And one also is generally operationally, when you solve a constraint, you remember that this constraint has been solved, which is patently not true for logic. In logic, you can prove the same thing over and over again, without having any clue that you are repeating your work. So this is what's exploited in CLP. Next slide, please, slide nine. So it's nice that we talk about rules, but using a meta notion of rules, I really adhere to presenting any operational semantics using Gordon Plotkin's structured-oriented structural rules. And these are very simple meta rules. they take a syntax, transform it into another syntax, provided a condition is satisfied. And this is how we're going to present all our constraint solving algorithms. Slide 10, please. So when you normalize such things at the meta level, you can get either something that is inconsistent and therefore you failed, or you can get something in normal form that is either solved or not. And if it's not solved but it's in normal form, we call that the residuated form. Essentially, you can view that as a suspended computation, and the only thing that is shared between the constraints and the relational items being variables, the variables act like inter-process communication channels. And this is also a very nice property of constraint logic programming because you have automatic coroutining. Slide number 11, please. So we move on to unification, and I go very fast there because most people know that. Slide 12. So slide 12 essentially presents the data structure used in Prolog, which is the first order term. And the first order term is essentially a tree where the leaves can have variables. And examples would be either a variable or a constant or a tree that has subterms that are themselves first order terms. Slide 13, please. And again, we have the notion of a substitution. And solving an equation is essentially solving a constraint of the form T equals T prime. Slide 14, please. And finding such a substitution is done by unification, and you want the most general solution, that is one that can generate any other solution if many exist. So if you take a first-order term equation like the one in the bottom, essentially you can normalize that into a substitution as given by the last line. Slide number 15, please. Okay, unification is very important, but it has been invented and reinvented over many times. The first mention of it was actually in Jacques Herbrand's PhD thesis. Jacques Herbrand was a brilliant logician, a French logician that unfortunately died a year after he did his PhD in 1931. And apparently John Allen Robinson was not aware at all of his work, because in his JACM article in 1965, he reinvented this, calling it unification. And again, it was represented by Martelli and Montanari in 1982. But all of it can be really simplified when we see unification as just a particular constraint normalization rule set. Slide 16, please. And slide 17 is very quickly, that is essentially you can present these two set of rules as changing using Plotkin structural-oriented structural rules as changing the syntax until they are normalized into a solved form or a failure. Slide 18, please. So now we move on to semantic objects. Slide 19. Anything that you see on the semantic web really has a graph nature. So objects are graphs. Essentially, you have three things: addresses of nodes, which are the red things; the content of nodes, which are the boldface things that are called sorts; and some particular nodes are at leaf and contain values. So if this is a two-dimensional picture that can be made linear using a linear syntax. Slide 20, please. For example, this is a linear syntax for the graph that we had in the previous slide, and slide 21 are the other one. And this syntax is the one that I'm going to formalize because it's all we need. It's a syntax that can represent graphs in general and generalizes the syntax of first-order terms, because the red things are essentially tags that will be identified to logical variables. The green things are sorts that are essentially the constructors of the graphs, and the blue things the green things are features that are edges, and the blue things are contents of the nodes. Slide 22, please. So this is the same for the types. Here we have an object, now we have other types. Slide 25, please. So slide 26. So we started this whole work, at least I started, when I was given KL1 in 1982 as the epitome of knowledge representation. Actually, it was a very interesting work. In 1979, Ron Brackman did his thesis at Harvard, and I read this thesis, and I was completely taken by it. It had a very clear analysis of how knowledge representation should be arranged in order to be useful. And this is a particular example, for example, of a persons, employees, and places, and things like that, with constraints that are equations among compositions of roles that are essentially binary relations. So slide 27. So actually, I skip a lot. Could you just move on to 54? Okay. Another thing about ontologies is that they're presented generally by partially ordered conceptual beings that are called sorts or types or whatever, and they have features. So the good question is that why not use logic again when we can represent everything in logic? And slide 55, please. But a very important thing is that proof equivalence doesn't mean model equivalence. And constraints have a very nice property, is that they are, they remember the fact that they were proven. So they remember, no constraint is ever proven twice. Slide 56, please. Actually, you can skip until 61 now, please. So to recapitulate, we can view a lot of structure as graphs. And when we view these graphs as constraints, we can provide a lot of possibility to have rules over these graphs. So could you go next, please, 62? In the search dealing with the semantic web, there has been a new trade called ontological programming that has been, unfortunately, very cluttered by superfluous syntax. As was mentioned before by Hector, I believe, one thing that is extremely hard to follow in this semantic web is the syntax, generally XML cluttered verbosity, and also the fact that we confuse decidability with efficient and indecidable with inefficient. But this is not true. A lot of undecidable things are very efficient, and I'd rather have something that is efficient, though incomplete, undecidable, rather than have something that is decidable but very inefficient because it's finite. Next slide, please, 63. Okay, next slide, please, and that will be essentially the summary of my position. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Hassan. Very interesting. Pascal, would you like to introduce the next speaker?
Certainly. So our last talk today will be given by Enrico Franconi. Enrico is a professor at the University of Bolzano in Italy, and of course Enrico is a capacity on ontology languages related to the web ontology language, but also to rules, and he has a track record of research in that area. Actually, one of the reasons why I considered asking him when Leo and me talked about this session was that I was rather sad that I missed his presentation at the International Semantic Web Conference this year, which is related to the topic of this session. And so I thought that would be an excellent opportunity to ask him to present something along the lines of that work, and I believe this is exactly what he's going to do now, and very happy about that. Thanks, Enrico, and it's your stage.
Thank you for the presentation. Okay, so I guess my talk is going to be slightly different from the previous ones because it's not really related to the notion of rules as an ontology language. So it's related to RDFS. Even though then at the end of the day, the talk is about how can we implement proper RDFS using rules. So I don't know whether this can be seen as a connection. My talk at the end, if you can go to the summary slide number 2, is can be summarized as follows. So I first try to tell you what is RDFS in as a standard and in the way people actually use it, because all the implementations of the RDFS engines respect this standard. And surprisingly, some people realized several years ago that the standard defines a language which is not really what you expect from such a language. So the semantics and the behavior of a standard normative RDFS is bizarre and does not comply to the expected semantics, which should be based on set theory, on the notion of set inclusion intersection. And these things were actually noticed while the RDFS was created by Pat Hayes. There's been some fixes, but then again, this didn't really solve the problem. So what we show in this work is how RDFS should actually be. So what would be the real semantics to be given to RDFS, and so that the behavior will be exactly the one that you expect. And this makes, by the way, RDFS compatible with OWL, while now, today, it's not compatible with OWL. And this is actually extremely surprising. But the most interesting part of this work is that at the end of the day, this change, this shift in the semantics and the meaning of RDFS, which makes RDFS really the right language, does not change the complexity and the way you would implement RDFS. You could still implement with your forward reasoning rules. So my last slide will be about a naive implementation using Apache Jina, and where we add a few rules, and this actually can work and implement completely this right understanding of RDFS. So if you go to slide number 3, I quickly say that in this work and in this presentation, I will focus on a core of RDFS, which is called RODF in the literature. So basically, you just trust me that this is a core, a fragment of the real RDFS that does not lose anything, okay? So this language is self-contained and does not depend on the thing that we forget about it. So we are talking about having type, which is the instance of the subclass, property, domain, and range. Okay, so in slide number 4, if you go to the first upper part, so 4A, let's say, I want to show you what should be the intended meaning of RDFS. So whenever I say that a class is a subclass of another one, so something like the palatable, the class palatable is a subclass of the class food, so anything which is palatable is also food, I really want this to mean that for any object which is an instance of palatable, this is also an instance of food. So basically that the extension of the class palatable should be a subset of the extension of class food. And whenever this happens, then we have the subclass. And if we go to the next slide, we see in the middle part of slide 4, what would be the semantics for subproperty. Subproperty says that, in this example, that slurps is a subproperty of eats. This means that any pair such that A slurps B, or that the red slurps blue, then we should have that the red also eats blue. So that anybody who's slurping something is also eating something. And vice versa. So if we add that whenever anybody is slurping something is also eating something, then this means that slurps is a subproperty of eats. In the last part of slide 4, if you can advance one step, I also exemplify the meaning of range, as we expect. So if we say that eats as range food, the property eats as range food, this means that for any pair such that pair of objects such that the first one eats the second one, this means the second one has to be an instance of class food. Okay, so this is what we expect. Now let's see what happens. So if in this example, if you go to slide 5, with this semantics, in this simple example, we say that germ slurps an ice cream, that slurps is a subproperty of some unknown property which has range food. Can we derive something out of it? Can we derive that ice cream is of type food? If we advance to second part of slide 5, we realize, yes, this is actually a valid entailment okay? Because all the pairs in slurps are also pairs in the red unknown property, and this unknown property has range food, therefore ice cream has to be tag food. Now, if you go to slide number 6, let's see actually what is the real semantics of RDFS as it is defined in the spec. Well, if you go to the first part, we see that we don't have really proper in the spec, in the normative semantics, we are not saying that subclass is exactly the subset of the two extensions. But it says that if palatable is a food, then all the instances of palatable are also instances of food, but we are not saying vice versa. This is what is written in the W3C specs. And if we advance in the other two parts of slide 6, you can see that this holds for all the four definitions, for subclass, subproperty, range, and domain. So what I'm showing here in slide 6 is that in the normative semantics, if you are a subclass, then you have all the instances of your superclass. But if you have all the instances of your superclass, then you are not a subclass. If you go to slide 7, I formalize this using a rule. And these are the rules that are then used to implement RDFS reasoning. So this says that if there is a triple such that A is a subclass of B, then for any object which is type of A, then this object X is also of type B. And this is a one-directional implication. So if I'm a subclass, then all my instances are also instances of the other one, but not vice versa. And this holds for the subclass, property, domain, and range. So in the red, you see that the implication go only from left to right. On slide 8, I show you that this semantics, this definition of the semantics, will lose something. So if we look the same example as before, where basically I expect that slurps is a subproperty of the red property, which is a subproperty of it. So I expect that by transitivity, slurps is a subproperty of it. But if you advance in the second part of slide 8, you realize that no, this does not follow from the semantics. So in principle, transitivity is not even following from the semantics that simplified semantics that has been defined by Pat Hayes. And why is that? Because because the subproperty would entail that all the pairs in slurps are also pairs in the red one. But this does not entail that this is another subproperty, because the other direction does not hold. So for this, if we go to slide number 9 and show it completely, the three parts, so we can see what is actually the standard semantics, the normal semantics of RDFS. So the upper part you see is the one I just told you. Subclass implies that all the instances of A are also instances of B, etc. And then there is a second part. The middle part of slide 9 shows you that transitivity has been added ad hoc in the spec. So if A is a subclass of B and B is a subclass of C, then A is a subclass of C. This has to be stated explicitly, otherwise transitivity would not hold. And then the last set of axioms, I skip it now, they are about typing. I don't want to spend time on this. So what I'm showing here in slide number 9 is that the normative semantic of RDFS has this weak semantics for subclass, property, domain, and range, and has added the transitivity. So if you go to slide number 10, is a summary of the results of the normative semantics. So basically, with this semantics, life is easy, because we can reason with RDFS, by reducing to reasoning in RDF, because we can compute a completion, a polynomial completion of my knowledge, and then on this completion, I can do our standard simple RDF queries. Okay. However, let's go to an example, and let me see whether this is a nice language. So the normative language is a nice one. So if you go to the last part of slide 11, you realize that some expected inferences do not hold. Take the middle one. I expect that slurps has range food. Why is that? Because LERFs is a sub-property of an unknown property, the red one. And this unknown property has a range food. But LERFs is a sub-property of a property which has range food. Therefore, logically, I expect that LERFs has a range food as well. However, the weak semantics defined by Pat Ayers in the W3C standard does not entail this thing. Because basically, no range, no domain can ever be inferred by the semantics because it's purely extensional. So it can only derive instances because of the way the semantics, because of the arrows going only from left to right, because I can only, on the right part of my rules, I have only statements of kind type instance, okay? So this is bad. RDFS, the way we use it, the way all the word uses, it's simply wrong because you don't derive things that you expect, okay? So what should we do? Slide 12 shows what should we do. Basically, the semantics should have the implication in both directions. So subclass is exactly subset, okay? So it's ever A is a class of B, then all the instances of A are also instances of B, and vice versa. So go to slide 13. With this semantics, of course, we get all the expected entailments correctly, okay? So, and this is just obvious, and this is what we want. Why people did not do this while defining the specs almost 10 years ago? The reason is because they thought that dealing with the proper, what we call extensional semantics of RDFS would have been too complex. So they conjectured that the reasoning would have been much more complex than they wanted to be, and therefore they basically limited themselves in the definition so that they could have simple way of implementing a reasoner. However, in this work, we showed that actually the opposite is true, that this, with the right semantics, a very simple extension of the reasoner will do the right thing. So in slide 14, we actually show this result. Basically, the complexity, theoretically, the complexity of entailment is the same. And moreover, we have a sound and complete algorithm that is exactly the same as the one for the standard RDFS. Namely, we can compute a polynomial completion of my knowledge, and then I can make a simple RDF simple entailment on top of this. So I can reduce to standard RDF entailment. Okay? And so I can use a standard forward chaining rule system, which computes the polynomial completion. Okay, if you go to slide 15, this shows that at this point, subclass in RDFS, in our RDFS, they call here RDFS plus, is exactly the same as our subclass. While probably nobody realized that currently RDFS subclass is not the same as our subclass. The same for domain, range, and subproperty. So this was a major mismatch that nobody realized. In this changing of the semantics of RDFS, so by having RDFS plus, we actually have the same semantics for the obvious thing. So the subclass means really subset. While in RDFS, I insist, subclass does not mean subset. Okay, last slide, number 16. Evaluation. So what we did, we took a number of RDFS knowledge bases, most notably DBpedia, FOF, which is small, but basically DBpedia is the biggest one that we considered, and others. And what we did, we applied our reasoner on top of that data. And you see that in the blue line, The entailment, the deduction that we can do with the incomplete standard normative RDFS. And in the red, you see how many more triples we derive, we deduce with the correct semantics. What does it mean? That there is a huge amount of knowledge that we don't get out of this knowledge basis because the reasoner don't have the right semantics for the data. Okay? So in all these examples, we derive many more triples. In the case of DBpedia, it's one-third more than the triple you would derive with the standard reasoner. And these other triples are triples that you actually expect to hold, okay? And this, in our very naive implementation, by we just added a few rules into Gina, did not cost horribly more than just the standard reasoner. So I really believe that with carefully thought optimization, we can have the very same cost.
Five minutes in, Enrico.
Well, if you go to slide 17, the last one, I have the conclusions. And so what I argued here is that we should, that original RDFS had the wrong semantics, and now with this, the right semantics, we make RDFS, let's say, respecting your expectation and fully compatible with OWL. Can be adopted as of today immediately because at no cost, all the reasons can be extended with the proper rules to capture these missing cases. It's fully backward compatible. And in fact, I was, there were people thought that there were people who were insisting that we submit this to W3C to have a new extension, this new extension as a standard in the forthcoming RDF 1.1. And this is it.
Okay, thank you very much, Enrico. At this point, what we'd like to do in our remaining time is to open the discussion up among our audience and the briefers. What we typically do is to, in the chat window, raise, hit the button that has the hand to raise your hand to ask a question or make a comment, and then direct it to whomever you would like to for discussion. And of course, the speakers can discuss as they see fit too. So we've had a lot of discussions in the chat room. Do we have some questions to ask? You'll have to also hit star 7 to unmute when you ask your question. Yes, Peter.
Thank you to all the speakers. I mean, the presentations were great. But I have a specific question for Enrico. Enrico, is Pat Hayes aware of your work and does he agree? Since standardizing, as you explained, is probably the best way to move this forward.
I'm not aware whether he has actually he knows about this very recent result. He's aware of the problem, though. So, in fact, even in the spec, he proposes the right semantics. And then he says, well, we don't really know much about it. There may be something we can do about it, but we prefer not to talk about it. Okay, so that's the, so he was aware he was actually dealing with an incomplete way. He actually did hide it a little bit because it did not tell the community that they were losing a number of interesting deductions. The straight answer to your question is that no, I'm not sure that he is aware about the result. Axel Polleris, who was the chair of the most recent Spark effort, he's aware and actually suggested me to submit it to the RDF 1.1. I don't know whether I really want to do this because I already participated to a couple of W3C committees and it's a nightmare. I'm not sure I want to enter this job anymore. Anybody who's willing to do it is welcome.
Well, I guess the least maybe that would move it forward is I guess to convince Pat since he's a really prominent voice in sort of the RDF 2 or 1.1, whichever way you call it. Thank you. Great presentation.
You're welcome.
Yes, was that a comment? Do we have any other questions from the audience or the participants? I saw that there was a lot of discussion in the chat room. Do people have had their questions answered by the speakers or cross comments among the speakers?
Since Alan Rector brought forth something that he started in the previous session, maybe Alan, you could provide your input again.
But I saw that Alan has left, according to the chat.
Oh, oops, too bad.
Just a few minutes ago. Well, I'd like to ask a question of Hassan when he was talking about his constraint logic approach. Do you, Hassan, do you see any real difference or clash between, constraint logic solution to ontology and rule reasoning versus current semantic web reasoning?
No, I don't see any clash. What I see is an opportunity for realizing how to exploit one paradigm versus another when one is most appropriate. In terms of rules, I see perhaps my approach as more low level, and I would see, for example, taking a lot of things that has been using the standard technology. I could think that it could be compilable, so to speak, translatable. Parts of them could be translatable in constraints so that to enhance some parts of the deduction process.
I see. Okay. Let's see. Harold, you have your hand raised.
All right. I have also a question for you, Hassan, about CEDAR, your new project in France to implement some of your work. Can you give us an update? Is it maybe even part of your 64 slides which you needed to skip?
No, it wasn't. And I didn't say a word because I don't think it was relevant, but it is a little bit. Essentially, this is an experimental project where we are trying to put to the test the current technology for essentially two properties, a scalability and distribution, because they happen to be the most critical. It's okay when you have your reasoner that works in one single machine or perhaps locally, but since we're talking about the semantic web, these two issues have to be addressed. Scalability, how to deal with enormous amounts of knowledge and data, and distribution, when this data and knowledge is distributed all over the place with nitty-gritty details to C2, like delays. So this is the kind of thing that we're working about with the CEDAR project.
Maybe one technical issue here is about slots or properties or roles or features. Many communities have different names. So we heard Enrico's talk about RDFS and sub-property of. So these are global attributes of properties that you can have sub-properties of other properties. But in your system in life, properties or features are local to each object in some sense.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point. It's just a matter of it's one step of reification, so to speak. It's been going on since the very early times of artificial intelligence and knowledge presentation. from so-called frame representations onto more onto different representations. Basically, you can take a term in Prolog and map it into a nest expression in Lisp. This is just a syntactic transformation. And I see the relation between the two things that you mentioned as essentially that sort of transformation. So if you want to represent a term the way I do it by extrapolating directly from the Prolog representation, then you can do also the same thing by extracting the contents of the nodes and mapping them onto meta relations like hash type or hash attributes or these kind of things. All you would do then is going one step of verification above. So I see that as just syntactic manipulations. As long as you can go from one representation to the other, knowing exactly what is what, then you're safe to reproduce reasoning in one representation with reasoning in the other representation. I'm not sure I made myself very clear, but as far
all
as
right.
I'm concerned,
yep, that's good.
They're just notation variants.
Okay, any other questions here? Patrick.
Enrique, the details of your paper, is that in the Springer publication? Where's the best place to get the complete details on the logic of extensional RDFS?
You can find it in the latest ISWIC proceedings. I will post the direct link now on chat, okay?
Excellent. And that includes the details of the evaluation?
Exactly. All the details of the evaluation as well, yes.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Very insightful. And thanks to all the other speakers as well. That's it for me, Neil.
Okay. Let's see. Any other questions? One of the issues that actually Hassan raised that has been emphasized in Semantic Web for quite some time, of course, and the description logic community is decidability. We have it as a goal in this series to address to some extent issues such as that, knowledge compilation issues, where you're interested in efficient runtime reasoning and have to perhaps limit the expressivity or transform the expressivity of the design time ontology plus rules. I wonder if any of our speakers have comments about that issue, let's say decidability versus efficiency. Yes, Marcus.
Yes, just briefly, I think that what description logics have often done is start with an undecidable language where the algorithms are known to not terminate at some point, and then, sorry, this is my phone, trying to find a sub-language where the algorithms terminate. So basically, it's not that really one limits the language to start with, but also often one says, okay, we want to have termination, and we want to understand in which cases our logic will terminate. And I think this is quite different from efficiency, but not terminating, from my perspective, is definitely not efficient. So I don't see that there's a real conflict between any of these things. And for me, mostly when working with undecidable languages, unless it's a programming language, it mainly seems to mean that people haven't quite understood yet in which cases the algorithms will work and in which cases they don't. That might be fine in some applications, but understanding it better, it will give you a sublanguage where you know your algorithm terminates. And I don't see that this is a practical disadvantage or maybe also not an advantage in some cases. So I don't think it's such a basic fundamental thing.
Okay, thank you, Marcus. Hector has a comment too.
Yes,
we can hear you.
Yeah, so
Yeah, what I would like to say is with respect to this undecidability and performance efficiency and stuff, for our customers, it doesn't really matter if the fragment is undecidable, provided that in their use cases, their particular ontologies, their particular applications work as expected, right? It could be that they are in a decidable fragment, for example, but given the nature of their TPOC, say, reasoning is very inefficient. And in that case, they couldn't care less about it being decidable. I mean, it's just a matter, I think, in practice, which is not surprising, I think that the question of performance and efficiency is more important than that of decidability.
Okay, excellent comment. Hassan, you have a comment.
Yes, I agree with the later statement, but in the context of actually widely distributed knowledge, where you have to take into account incrementality. Essentially, you are going to receive information from distributed places, nodes in your network at different speeds, and you cannot even decide whether these will ever terminate. So I'd rather take incompleteness and efficient processing of whatever I get as I get it, rather than just insisting on being complete and efficient and decidable. So this is in this context that I situate myself.
Yes, okay, that's an interesting comment. We've had issues in the past, this is just a personal observation, where we have static ontologies, but at runtime perhaps we want to allow for incremental or dynamic modification, and many times that really causes assumption reasoning, and even if you're using transformations or codification of the knowledge, becomes problematic to dynamically add classes and properties, for example. So that has been one of our issues.
But sorry, if I may add something here.
Sure.
I follow you there. But even if you don't go so far as talking about what I would call knowledge evolution and evolution management, even when you don't go there, there's one thing that is very interesting about the approach that I favor. Presenting everything as a constraint set is that you have one property that you can guarantee with these rules is that they are commutative. That is, they can be applied in any order. And therefore, that gives you the freedom to process knowledge as it comes. So that is something, a detail maybe, but a very important one as far as I'm looking. So this is the sort of thing that I'm considering. If it's incomplete, it's not really a bigger problem to me. What's incomplete is that what's important is that I process things as it materializes.
I see, yes, okay. additional comments, folks? Pascal, I don't know if you have some comments too.
Nothing specific here. I mean, there was very interesting discussion going on in the chat, so I made my comments there. I'm very happy about the presentations. So yeah, was a great session.
Okay, well, we have we're close to being at our termination point here. We do have a couple minutes, so if there are any other additional comments or questions, people should ask them. And if not, then what we'll do is conclude. We thank all of our speakers for an extremely great session. This was very useful knowledge. each of the speakers provided to us that we probably didn't know at all prior to this session. And I thank Pascal for co-chairing this with me, and I thank Peter for helping us to administer and organize the session, and the participants. Thank you for participating, and please join us for our next session, which will be the 19th of December, but Peter has also commented that we're going to have our first ontology summit discussion on December 5th in 2 weeks. So with that, I thank you all and say goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.